Deutsche Welle. Living Planet.
From DW Studios in Bonn, this is Living Planet, and I'm Charlotte Lomas. Coming up on the show, taming the wild, the invasive species that's devastating Florida's Everglades.
The Burmese python can do just fine in our environment. He has a very voracious appetite, so as they have mated and increased, they've eaten up everything in the glades. Raccoons, rabbits, deer, and now they've actually started going after alligators.
Getting a taste of the wild, literally.
This is braised raccoon with smoked corn and bean salsa, creme fraiche, and micro arugula.
Alligator meatballs. It's ground, it's fried, it's a little delicious.
A new food movement for those game enough to try. Plus, guinea pigs, cuddly pet, or culinary delight. Stay tuned to find out. But first, discovering a new species is an exciting feat for any scientist. But what if sharing that special find was putting animals in harm's way? A new study published in the journal Science warns that poachers and animal traffickers are using scientific data published online to track down rare and endangered species. It found that more than 20 newly discovered creatures had been targeted because their locations had been made public. To find out more, I spoke to David Lindemeyer, a conservation biologist at the Australian National University in Canberra.
Well, what first alerted us to this problem was our own studies, which have been looking at wildlife on farms here in Australia, which requires us to deal on a daily basis with many private landowners who run farms. And we started to discover populations of a rare legless lizard, which is a sort of bizarre form of legless gecko that occurs mostly only in Australia. And these animals occur in special habitats, rocky outcrops. And soon after we were forced to publish the locations of our field records of this animal, some of our landowners started to report that they were getting people coming to their land looking for these same animals. And that alerted us to the fact that online information was being used by people to work out where these animals were occurring. And when we began to look at the issue more deeply, we discovered that there are many other parts of the world where this is a problem. And a good example is the Chinese tiger gecko or cave gecko, very spectacular animal. And in many cases, soon after information is published about where they occur in their habitat, these animals are poached in the wild and then taken onto the illegal wildlife market. And in fact, if you go onto Google, Professor Google will help you find where you can get Chinese cave geckos for $150 delivered door to door. So essentially what's happening is the internet and all this online open access information is basically the catalyst for a massive surge in poaching of wild animals, creating another major problem for the world's biodiversity.
And so to what extent is this information available online?
So one of the big issues now is that when you publish a scientific paper or when you do a field survey, it's a mandatory requirement of publication or a field research permit to publish your information online so that it's open access, so that anybody can access that information and reuse it. And this is part of getting a grant, publishing a paper, getting a research permit. And what's happened is that poachers and other people are now alert to this fact and are able to readily access the information that they want to be able to locate the species that they want.
And so is this piggybacking on scientific research new for poachers?
Yes and no. Most smart poachers that have an interest in making money and are sophisticated will read information about what sorts of animals fetch high prices, where they can access those animals, what their habitats are, and then work out how to connect with the illegal pet market. And so really what's happened is that now with open access information and mandatory publication of open access information, that essentially has created a fantastic ability for illegal pet trades, wildlife pet trades, all those kinds of things to basically be on steroids relative to where they were before. So it's really catalysed the problem. as it were, to make it significantly worse than it would have been 10, 20, 30 years ago. So we've always had poachers. Now all they have to do is sit with a computer and they can work out what they can access where.
Sharing scientific research is supposed to help conservation, but in this particular case, its publication is threatening the existence of these species. So what does this mean for scientists wanting to share their work online?
So this is not an unusual kind of problem in the broader scientific world. And in fact, the paleontologists and archaeologists have been dealing with this for quite some time because of the potential to destroy fossil deposits or to desecrate important archaeological sites. And so they have processes for masking out the locations of these important areas so that so they're not defiled. Individual scientists need to think deeply about the kinds of information that they publish, particularly about charismatic animals that might be targeted in the poaching trade, and particularly animals that are being recently described, because there's a special stigma associated with newly described animals as being ones that particular kinds of unscrupulous collectors want to have in their collections. You know, the night parrot would be a classic example of that, the rare Australian parrot that's only just been rediscovered, thought extinct for well over 100 years.
Now, it's not just poachers and wildlife collectors that are jumping on these scientific papers. It's also people with good intentions.
Yeah, the problem is not only people that poach animals, but also wildlife photographers and also people that just love wildlife. So they'll often want to go to places to take photographs to post on their Facebook sites or to take photos so that they can then on-sell them, because there's a big industry in selling wildlife photographs. And we have good evidence of where these kinds of problems have led to significant habitat destruction, and essentially that's as good as killing the animal because their habitat is basically destroyed. The case of the corroboree frog, this extraordinary yellow and black beautiful animal in this country that's highly endangered, it's had its habitat frequently destroyed by people wanting to basically dig them up and be able to photograph them and paste them on their web pages, on their Facebook page or try to on-sell the photograph.
That was Professor David Lindemeyer talking to me from Canberra. As we just heard, the desire to keep rare and exotic animals as pets is fueling the illegal wildlife trade. But what happens when these animals escape or get released into a new environment? In Florida's Everglades, the invasive Burmese python's population has exploded. The giant snakes have a voracious appetite and are devastating the native wildlife in one of America's most ecologically diverse areas. In a bid to tackle the problem, local authorities have sent in a select group of python hunters as part of a pilot program. From there, our reporter Maria Bakalapolo has more.
The word Everglades means river of grass. Not only is this a river, but it is the slowest moving river in the world. It only travels 1 mile a day. 120 miles long, 50 miles wide, this is everybody's fresh water supply from Pompano Beach all the way to the Keys. We got needlegrass, which is this stuff beside us here to the right. That's all sawgrass. Then you got the lily pads, which are the pads that are laying flat on the water.
The Everglades once covered the whole of South Florida, a vast shallow river teeming with life. Now its eastern edge is defined by the city of Miami. To the north, sugar plantations have prospered. With a large human population drawn to the sunny climate, development has been incessant, and the tropical ecosystems have suffered. Today, the Everglades is half of its former size. 68 endemic species here are threatened or endangered, a lot of it due to invasive species, especially the Burmese python. Charles Kropke, tour operator, filmmaker, and conservationist, explains how the great snakes got to the Everglades.
You know, so you get a young guy who wants to have a snake around his neck, you know, show his bad snake to the girls. But a couple months in, or a year in, the snake is big and long and fat, and he wants two rabbits a week, you know, and that's expensive. So he takes it out to the Everglades and he says, here you go, and he releases it. Unfortunately, because of our environment, our subtropical environment, the Burmese python can do just fine in our environment. And he has a very voracious appetite. So as they have mated and increased, they've eaten up everything in the glades. Raccoons, rabbits, deer, and now they've actually started going after alligators.
Local surveys show population of raccoons and possums have dropped by over 90%. Bobcats, more than 87%. And pythons have all but wiped out the reintroduced marsh rabbit. The Burmese python has become so dominant that it is giving the longtime apex predator, the alligator, some stiff competition. The climate conditions and abundance of prey in the Everglades means pythons thrive. One female can lay up to 100 eggs. Various state agencies have responded by launching python hunts. The South Florida Water Management District is running a pilot program until June 1st. Any snake over 4 feet has a bounty on its head of $50, or about 45 euros, plus 25 for every additional foot of length. The program also pays each hunter the state's minimum wage. They have caught over 100 so far.
Rolling, rolling, rolling. Get those pythons rolling.
Meet Thomas Rahill, founder of the Swamp Apes, a group mostly made up of military veterans, dedicated to combating invasive animals and plants in the Everglades. The program gives the vets a chance to be reintroduced into civilian life and use their training to help save the wetland area.
Pythoning is nothing like you'd expect it to be, but it's everything you'd hope for. To drive on a road at night, bright spotlight, and you're looking for a shadow, large dark shadow across the road. And then you get out and you hopefully successfully capture the python if you come across it. It's not as extreme as some people would lead you to believe. Although when you come across a really big python, I don't care where you are, it's extreme. They're an amazing animal, very dangerous animal. You have to know what you're doing. Really exciting stuff and very rewarding to get a python out. It's a shame though, it's a double-edged sword. Pythons are beautiful, but they are causing such harm.
For hours upon hours, they drive along the levees, hoping for something to slither past. It might be hanging from a tree or warming itself on the road, or they might spend a whole week of 12-hour days looking and find nothing, like this evening. There are financial and ecological reasons to keep going, but it's also kind of addictive. The landscape is spectacular with an ecosystem like no other, because it derives its water from rainfall. Thomas feels deeply connected to the place.
I don't know if you can feel it, but it's not heavy. There's a point where the temperature changes, the wind goes down, and there's a settling that takes place. Like a Everglades blanket just lays down over the wild area. The window where the critters move.
Where have all the pythons gone? Long time passing. Where have all the pythons gone? Long time ago.
We'll start with the back end here. This animal came in with a prolapsed colon.
Christopher Smith and Andrea Zimendi are Swamp Apes board members and animal veterinarians at the Wellaby Veterinary Hospital in Sunrise, Florida. Here you can hear them examine a python.
He does have a couple of sutures there that are keeping it in place.
They help state agencies locate and study Burmese pythons using tracking devices. They also train new swamp apes to restrain the massive constrictor when they find one. No mean feat, given they can grow up to 20 feet.
Yeah, you generally want to control the most dangerous aspect of the animal, which in their case is their mouth at first. So if you're able to grab behind their skull and restrain that way, and then you're able to better control their body.
Christopher and Andrea hold a 5-foot male python on an examination table to check its health and give it some antibiotics. In 2010, the Florida Fish and Wildlife Commission signed rules that prohibit anyone from owning Burmese pythons and other reptiles of concern as pets. Little is known about the Burmese python, and even less about how it lives in the Everglades. The full extent of the damage they could cause here remains to be seen.
In my opinion, I think the python problem is very bad, and probably we don't know the full scope of how bad it is because we still don't know everything there is to know about these animals. The relationships that happen in any ecosystem are exceptionally complex. And when you throw something into that ecosystem that's not supposed to be there, you can see some very obvious abnormalities. The mammal populations start to drop. The biodiversity starts to plummet. But how do those ripple effects start to go outwards? I don't even know that we have a grasp of that yet.
So far, hunters have bagged just over 100 Burmese pythons since the hunt started, one nearly 17 feet long and weighing in just over 65 kilos. All pythons must be euthanized, their eggs destroyed, before leaving the Everglades. It's a drop in the ocean considering the population here is estimated anywhere from 10,000 to 100,000. But it's an enthusiastic start, and so far the best defense the Everglades has against this reptilian invasion. For DW, I'm Maria Bacalopoulou in the Everglades.
Well, the Burmese python isn't the only one with a taste for raccoon and bobcat. One American food personality is also serving these small wild animals up for dinner in New York. For 7 years, he's been working with fur trappers who started serving the meat from the skins and furs they sell. While some activists argue killing animals for their fur is cruel, is eating game meat rather than, say, mass-farmed chicken or pork an environmental act? Well, DW reporter Daniela Cheslow went to a recent small game feast in New York to find out.
Snapping turtle and beaver?
How should I eat this?
With your mouth.
There's no beating around the bush at the small game dinner in the Bronx. If you're here, it's for a taste of the wild.
This is braised raccoon with smoked corn and bean salsa, creme fraiche, and micro arugula.
Alligator meatballs. It's ground, it's fried, it's a little delicious.
Top chefs are embracing the farm-to-table movement. But at this dinner, Justin Fornell is bringing meat from trappers and hunters to New York. Most people know him as Baron Ambrosia, a local food TV personality.
I like to finish each bite by adding a sprinkling of jazz fingers for a flair of mild bravado. But be aware, this move will not go unnoticed.
The Baron spends most of his evening chatting with guests, but I catch him in the kitchen. Cooks arrange serving platters for barbecued bear. The Baron tells me this all started 7 years ago when he met a fur trapper selling coyote and raccoon pelts.
And I had always been curious, you know, what happens to the meat of these animals? What happens to the bones? What happens to the glands? And I was interested to find out that most of those things weren't being utilized.
That's where trapper Bill Giles from New Jersey comes in. He's at tonight's dinner wearing a thin white earring dangling from his left ear.
It is a male mink penis bone.
And a hat made of coyote pelts he caught himself. Before he met the Baron, trapper Bill says he used to leave the meat that he caught in the forest. Now he's the chief supplier of tonight's food.
It makes me feel good to see that it's going to some good use.
200 people come to tonight's dinner. You can't get this meat almost anywhere else. The dress code is formal, but it includes hunting attire. One guest is wearing a guinea pig skull as a necklace. Trapper Tim Romaine strung a full squirrel pelt down his shirt, like a tie. Did you catch that squirrel?
Yes. You cut across the back legs, remove the body, remove the bone from the tail, and I sent it to a tannery.
Can I touch it?
Yeah.
It's very soft.
Yep.
We head into the main dinner hall. A dozen dancers dressed like Egyptian gods perform an opening ceremony. The Baron takes the microphone.
How many people is this your seventh dinner?
Animal rights activists say the fur trade is cruel and should be banned. So I wondered, could eating wild game be considered an environmental act? Jim Posowitz worked at the Montana Fish, Wildlife, and Park Service for 40 years before he founded Orion, the Hunters Institute. I reached him by phone at his Montana home.
Sun is shining, and there are deer tracks in my yard.
Jim says hunters like him have played a crucial role in American environmental history. Take President Teddy Roosevelt, the architect of the U.S. Forest Service and an avid hunter. Jim says when you buy a hunting license, you're paying to protect the habitats of the animals you're pursuing.
When we settled this country, we basically took the continental wildlife populations to near extinction. And now we have restored, through hunter-driven conservation and restoration programs, an exceptional abundance.
Back at dinner, there's a course of beaver meat rolled up in sushi. There's bobcat stewed in cinnamon. I head over to the bar, which is stocked with glass vats holding alcohol infused with beaver gland, bear paw, and crow.
The bear paw, I prefer this one. Let me see, you have something, you have a glass to drink out.
The beaver booze is aromatic and tastes like resin. But actually, my biggest challenge with this dinner is how, with all the variety, a lot of the meat just tastes like meat. So if I were in a supermarket faced with a choice of industrially raised chicken or wild coyote, I might go for the wild. Or for vegetables. For DW in New York, I'm Daniela Cheslow.
Well, if eating small game isn't to your taste, it's highly unlikely our next report will titillate your taste buds. Most people see them as fluffy pets, but in Peru, guinea pigs are a delicacy that are helping farmers get out of poverty. Their rise in popularity in Lima's high-end restaurants has prompted many people to start breeding them, including some foreign investors. We sent our reporter Jane Chambers to find out more.
Being here is a bit like being in a giant pet shop. I am surrounded by, I think, hundreds of fluffy guinea pigs, black, white, brown. You can probably hear them behind me. And I'm about to talk to their owner.
Alessio Cris, el dueño de la granja Camero.
I'm the owner of this farm, along with my Peruvian wife and mother-in-law. So this is a family business where we breed guinea pigs. It's something that's really taken off in the poorer areas of Peru, where people are earning below the minimum wage and have to feed a family of up to five people. Breeding pigs or chickens would be much more expensive for them. The startup costs are so much cheaper with this. One guinea pig costs about a dollar. They don't need expensive vaccines or a lot of food, and they breed quickly. That's why poor people choose to get involved, because it gives them an income and something to eat as well. As well as selling to restaurants, we also help out with social projects in our neighborhood and give people the guinea pigs they need to start them off.
Now, as far as I'm aware, they don't eat guinea pig in Italy. So what made you decide to come to Peru and start doing this?
It's true, in Italy people don't eat guinea pigs. It's not something we typically eat in Europe. But when I came to Peru and met my wife, I started to eat them with her and her family. And it was then that I discovered how great a food this is. And that's when the business took off. It doesn't have cholesterol and is high in protein. Also, studies show it's meant to help with prostate cancer. And it's cheap. So not only does it help your health, it helps you to save as well.
Although some people in Peru have been eating guinea pigs for thousands of years, it's only recently that it's become popular across the country. In the past, it was only people in the Andes who ate them on special occasions. But when they migrated to Lima, other people, including high-end restaurants, started getting a taste for cuy. Now breeders can sell their guinea pigs for up to $13. Not bad when you consider that the basic wage for many peasant farmers is $30 a month. And the process of breeding them is quick and simple, as Alessio's wife, Sheila Camero, explains.
Here is where we breed the guinea pigs. We have a barn with lots of different pens and also land for growing their food, which is mainly corn. It takes around 2.5 months for them to be ready for eating.
And how do you like to eat your guinea pig? What's a good way to eat it for you?
I like it when they take the bones out, so it's just meat and nothing else. You can also have barbecued guinea pig. This is often served with everything, including the teeth and claws. You can also have it chopped up and deep fried like chicken, or as a stir fry. There are so many different ways.
Leonor Virgil is the regional director of a charity called World Neighbours, which helps farmers to start breeding guinea pigs. He travels all over Peru for his work. As well as restaurants in Peru, he says there's also a market taking off in the United States.
Peruvians have migrated to the United States mainly, so there is a high demand for guinea pigs in the United States. So there is a company that is exporting 2 tons a month to selling those guinea pigs to Peruvians, but also to Bolivians and Colombians and Ecuadorians that are living in the United States.
And how much are people prepared to pay for a guinea pig in the United States?
Well, they pay for each guinea pig $30 for each one, and they use it in a special occasion. They don't buy it every day like chicken. They buy only for a special occasion like birthdays, celebrations, or wedding celebrations, anniversaries. And those guinea pigs are prepared, basically fried and cut in pieces like chicken, and they eat in a big celebration.
But it's the recent culinary boom in Peru that's really driving business. And it's the increasing demand from high-end and mid-range restaurants that are changing the lives of people like Rosa, a guinea pig farmer.
It's good business. It used to be only people in the mountains who bred them. But these days, everyone wants to get involved, and there are farms all over Peru. And now I can afford things that I never could before, like helping to educate my children.
So although for many people around the world, guinea pigs are always going to be fluffy pets, for an increasing number of people in Peru, they offer a way out of poverty. Jane Chambers, DW, Lima.
Say, woman, what's this stuff you cooking? Now that meat and no potatoes, I just seem right like a green tomato.
Our program today was produced with the help of Natalie Muller, Eliana Giaducci, and Christoph Kulver. You can listen to Living Planet anytime on iTunes and SoundCloud, or you can find us on Facebook and Twitter at DW Environment. I'm Charlotte Lomas. Until next week.
Alligators. Now hold me steady. I'm really ready. Now all that meat and no potatoes.
I don't think that peas are bad. With me, most anything goes.
Yes, I looked in the pot. I'm fit to fight. 'Cause, woman, you know that mess just ain't right.
Oh, that's all. Oh, all that meat and no potatoes just ain't right, like green tomatoes.
Woman, I'm steaming, yeah, really screaming. All that meat and no potatoes.
bad. With me, most anything goes.